that the whole universe is a breathing organism, and that everything is living because it's breathing. So consciousness of your breath becomes a primary skill set that you develop. Then the other seven steps basically are practicing to recognize the importance of your vocabulary, because your headspace is filled with whatever.
At 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Morning, wherever you are in the world, you're listening to us live on Ye Old Internet. This is the Voice of the People Radio, being broadcast to you live this afternoon from 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're in New York City, welcome to the Voice of the People Radio. I know everybody's chomping at the bit to listen to Stephanie Benetti up there in New York City and Joe Montaldo after Voice of the People Radio. Don't forget to catch them on news on the flip side, along with all of the different segments. It would take me probably 5 minutes to list everybody, so we just won't. And I would like to welcome my guest to the Voice of the People Radio here on United Public Radio Network, 107.7 FM in beautiful downtown New Orleans, 105.3 and 107.9 in Pass Christian, Mississippi. Rick Osmond, you have graced us with your presence yet again, and I guess what we're sort of doing is not only talking about things that are going on now, events that are coming up for you, but all kinds of craziness this week, isn't it?
It has been a lot of craziness on a whole bunch of fronts. Yeah, and I'm in a band now, so I've been staying up late. So I'm tired. I'll get over it.
it's the wonderful world of caffeine.
Yes. I could not function without it. Well, I'd function, but nobody would like to be around me.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things. But I guess I could say this without insulting anyone's intelligence. My brother was trying to explain that very premise to some Mormon missionaries who happened to be coming to him in Ohio. And they didn't seem to understand, you know, his predicament, that he could give them his coffee, but then if he had a guest at his home, how is he going to entreat them to the beverage? And so that didn't end very well.
Yeah, Joe didn't do him a lot of favors with that banishment of a liquid essential of life, I guess, for some of us. He did not ban tobacco.
Yeah, we had a really interesting conversation about all that. I guess you could sit and speak with some missionaries, I guess, from just about any denomination of any kind, as long as they're willing to knock on your door. And sometimes they want to act like they're not exactly 100% aware of the history of their own faith or their sect or however that goes. So,
and most of them are not.
It's unbelievable. And then they could just use Google and Wikipedia and find out so much more.
Well, with a few devils in the details. But, yes, I had a Jehovah's Witness come to the house one time, different house. I had a very secluded place. And she noted that it's a very secluded place you have here. And I said, yeah, I kind of like it that way. But you found it anyway, didn't you? So it went completely over her head. Missionaries are a source of amusement for me. regardless of the sect or denomination or whatever, because they usually come at a time, it just happens this way, they come at a time when I have time to devote to my amusement, and I do.
It's sort of like my wife ended up entertaining herself and also the Latter-day Saints missionaries a couple of weeks ago here in Mississippi. And I was pretty nice about the whole thing. I mean, they left with some granola bars and, you know, a book by Michael Salas about UFOs. So they've parked their bicycles on the other side of the street, and they don't come to the door.
I had it wasn't a missionary, it was a coworker in that particular instance, and I happened to be reading a UFO book on break, and he said, oh, you shouldn't do that. And I said, and at the time I could actually quote what verse it was, but know the face of thine enemy. So you should be reading it too. And he gave up. But if you consider it an enemy, you should know it.
And there's a lot of rampant speculation going on with who exactly is the face of the enemy. We had two unfortunate shooting incidents, I guess, in the past, what is it, something like 72, 96 hours. Sort of hard to keep track with all of it, Rick. One of them was a apparently deranged mental patient in Canada that attacked Parliament.
Took on the whole government by himself.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, we're not racial profiling or anything like that. It seems from the information I was able to glean from sources that will threaten to sue me if I read their article, Associated Press, the gentleman is of some form of Middle Eastern descent. Obviously, that's not really relevant at this point in time because the Canadian Parliament Sergeant-at-Arms decided to do his job.
And dispatched the individual.
And according to our producer there, Joe Montaldo, probably, you know, with some relish, he did his dispatch.
Any time that somebody shows up uninvited with a gun, they will get the same treatment in most houses of government. And, well, in the U.S., in most houses, period. There are 82 million known gun owners, estimated, I should say, gun owners in the United States, with over 400 million guns at their disposal.
And that's kind of I guess it's a deterrent for anybody that becomes what we would call power mad in the United States. And there are a lot of people around the world that sort of, they look at us and say, well, it's just a nation full of gun nuts.
Well, it's a nation full of people who want to preserve their constitution and their constitutional right to keep and bear arms. And that is a two-parter, incidentally, Mr. Supreme Court Justice. It's keep and carry, because they're both in there.
Yeah, and it's you know, questionable. There are a couple of states, I'm not going to go naming everything off, but where it is even legal for you as a member of the state government to carry your weapon into the seat of government, and you're an acting a sitting member of the state legislature.
Yep. And I believe Indiana is one of those, and it came up for a vote again a few years back, and it was, you know, held.
You know, it brings to mind that unfortunate case with that congresswoman. I think she was in New Mexico. And not to sound silly to anybody, but if she was carrying a pistol, she might not have been able to directly defend herself against the potential assassin.
I mean, the guy that looked suspiciously like Glenn Beck, but I mean, they were doubles, but yeah, she probably was not the real target. There was a judge killed in that, you know. That's my conspiracy theory for the day.
You know, it's just those type of things happen. They think that, one person or the other is the target of intent, but it's not out of the question that those people, those people whoever they may
be. I am not experiencing secondhand smoke. I'm experiencing firsthand smoke. It's coming over the airwaves to you.
You know, they'll target an entire airliner.
Yeah.
To take out one person. We had an incident years ago now where we had a plane and the foreign government said that it violated airspace. We had a representative on that plane. I think that something close to that is probably what was responsible. You know, the reason behind the shoot down of the airplane in that zone over
flight 007, incidentally, over part of Russia.
And those incidents on their side, on the Russian side, had seemed to be increasing last month.
Yeah,
and we had multiple incursions into NORAD airspace, and it's again one of those things. Keep the public in this mounted sense of fear, not necessarily in a panic, but if people are only fed so much information at a time, they don't know what to do next, so they're just waiting for the government to tell them what to do.
Yep.
And it becomes a very dangerous place to have yourself hanging, because most of the time people with these government programs are all too willing to sit up there with a big pair of shears, and they're ready to take and just cut that safety line. In one case, we're gonna jump back into that Canadian thing. The first thing being criticized wasn't the reaction by the sergeant at arms at the parliament in taking this guy out. It was, this supposed, and I say the word supposed, uproar with people reacting to the fact that this gentleman was in and out of the correction system and in and out of the hospitals in Canada and was not, locked up safely in a room for the protection of others.
It is, however, proof that someone who should not have a gun can get one. So the legal gun owners, the people who are of sound mind, will experience more difficulty getting a gun even in Canada where they already can't than they need to. They don't need to be controlled. It is those people who cannot be controlled who need to be controlled.
And there's people that would, they would try to disagree with that point, simply because they would say, well, I don't believe anybody should be controlled by anybody at any time.
Well, that's pretty much a libertarian view. And you hear, oh, well, it's going to be a gunfight at the OK Corral. Well, the OK Corral lasted 38 seconds. And it was four lawmen against six cowboys who had already raised hell for 6 months and killed people. And drug them behind horses, et cetera. And it was the biggest incident of the decade where five guys died. It was the biggest shooting spree in one 38-second period that the West had experienced. Today, the OK Corral would seem like a cakewalk by comparison to some of the incidents that almost always involve Ritalin or some psychoactive drug. By the shooter.
And that, I guess, sort of leans us towards asking that question about the incident that happened the other day with the school shooting yet again. And, I felt badly for the police commander who is sitting there, and then you just sort of want to reach through the television screen or the radio and slap some of the news reporters because they keep asking the same questions, and he's already answered and said, I don't have any more information about that at this time. I don't know if it's a staff member that's involved. The other person that was killed. We can't tell you at that point in time if the shooter took their own life. We can't confirm the details. And the reporters are asking these questions based on information that is coming to them from kids and adults in the buildings at the campus with Twitter on their cell phones.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a news reporting of today. Get the first-hand report that got it third-hand to begin with. It's they don't vet the stories. They don't. I mean, you got the Inquirer. You've got the Examiner, you've got the World Net Daily. They'll publish anything. They don't check any facts. And and they half the time don't even have a byline for whoever submitted it. That way it's not traceable.
And the scary part about that, Rick, is if we dig into it a little bit without being complete cynics, it's advertising revenue driven.
Completely.
And they're just worried about being the first one to pop up if somebody's sitting there, they hear something on the radio or a blurb or somebody hollers out of the living room that's watching TV, hey, this happened on blah, blah, blah. They immediately jump on Google.
Mm-hmm.
They type in whatever the thing was that, you know, Aunt Martha yelled in from the living room. And there is that non-vetted, you know, story that the website thinks, oh, well, we can just edit this again later and, you know, if we have to publish any kind of retractions or apologies or whatnot.
And they never do. But it stays out there as information, false or fictitious or just error-filled. Regardless, it's not true. And it drives me nuts. And you get the same thing in the... I'm going to bring this full circle. You get the same thing in my research. You have a lot of people who make claims, whether they're scientists or amateurs, that they can't really back up. Or they'll find some obscure source where somebody wrote it down. Okay, that doesn't make it true just because somebody wrote it down. But they don't go any further. They just say, oh, it's got to be true. It's written down. No, it doesn't have to be true.
There's a lot of older UFO airship sightings and things like that in the 19th century were published in exactly the same manner, except without the internet, and they try to call that the golden age of yellow journalism, and
yes.
They would print just about anything to get their circulation up, and then somebody comes along, you know, 100 years later, and they say, well, I found this in an archive of the such and such times.
Right, the 1896-1897 airship mystery has spawned half a dozen, maybe a dozen different books on the topic. And they're split pretty evenly on whether it was all yellow journalism or whether there were really sightings. Well, let's go back and examine what is history. There was one guy who actually built airships and sought a U.S. Army contract. He got a contract, but it was not from the U.S. Army, and he built airships. They did exist. There may have been another separate group of amateurs building airships, and that is the topic of my buddy Dennis Crenshaw's book, the Sonora Aero Club. Incidentally, I'll plug Dennis's book there. And I helped him do a little legwork because I happened to be out there for day job stuff, and tramped around in cemeteries and libraries and whatnot, and I didn't find any airships. In fact, I didn't find anybody in the cemeteries who were mentioned in the whole thing by Charles A.A. Delshaw. Anybody who doesn't know the story, we can't do that one in 2 hours, but it's an interesting story.
And that reminds me of, you know, my wife does genealogy research, you know, and it's exactly the same thing as you going through the cemetery, look for people that are mentioned in the story.
Yeah.
But she's looking for facts to back up things that have been handed down orally by family tradition, and she starts digging through census records and things, and most of the stuff never happened.
Right. Or it happened and it was somebody else. That's fairly common, too. There's a story within my family of a battle, a skirmish, a fight, a brawl. That's really what it was between my great-great-great-great-grandfather and his hunting partner, but they were hunting Native Americans, and a group of Native Americans. Well, the partner, whose name of record was Tom Eagle, but he was called Bill throughout my family lore, and he was killed during this brawl, and so was a couple of the Native Americans. But the brawl was actually recorded and became a murder trial because Bill/Tom died. So that one really happened, and my ancestor was the only witness, and they issued a death warrant for unnamed Big Indian.
Unnamed Big Indian.
Yep. And it made the newspapers around here. Well, okay, there was only one. It made the newspaper around here. But the actual trial records were lost in a courthouse fire, one of three in this county. the last one being arson, because there was something in there that had to go away.
Yeah, that happens all too often, doesn't it?
Seems like it.
Especially when it comes to property ownership and tracing the history of property ownerships and things, Rick. And
yeah.
You know a little bit about that. You know, it's kind of funny that, you know, we sit here, you know, in a country that we call the United States that is structured on claims of property ownership and rights and things that are granted by monarchs hundreds of years ago. And that's another big one, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's one of those points of amusement. It's, you know, one of the things my wife likes to point stuff out to me, and she showed me that the Vatican has now released a certain number of records that they have digitized, and interestingly enough, you will not find the records that you would be looking for among the ones that have been released. So they were kind of selective in their process.
Yeah. But I think there's one that may not be this most recent release. I believe it was the one about 10 years ago, 8-9 years ago, where there was a reference within those references to something that somebody was talking about or seeking. So they know that it's either still in there or it has been destroyed.
And one of the funny things about those Vatican records is you could have something that had been available, then blocked by the current sitting administration under whoever the Pope is.
Right.
And it can be, because of the way the church functions, it could be, restricted against public release for all time.
Yep.
And for people that aren't that,
You know, they don't answer to anybody on the planet.
Yeah, that entire relationship is a little funny, because we have over 240 different countries in the world right now, and everybody seems to have an ambassador to the Vatican.
Yeah, even the Arab countries.
And that's one of those things that sort of, you know, makes you pause and say, And
yeah, they may not believe it, but they don't want to not hedge their bet, I guess.
Yeah, it was an interesting point. Peter Kling was my guest Tuesday night. I was guest hosting the Dawn of Shades here on United Public Radio Network. And he was talking about, you know, the idea that Queen Elizabeth is, subject to the seat of the Vatican, and also that Nelson Mandela was a Knight of Malta, and we didn't really elaborate on what all of that means, but it basically means that they have submitted themselves to this other authority, and then we also have the. I guess, would you call it a rumor, Rick, as I talk with Rick Osmond here, about the United States still being subject to the British Empire under the rules of admiralty?
As far as the rules of admiralty, the UN is trying to do away with those. Let's get that out of the way right now. The UN wants to own all the oceans and everything on and in them. As far as the admiralty of the UK over the US, there are parts of the Treaty of Paris that were not overridden at the end of the War of 1812 that should have been. And it included the only thing that they actually got out of it, the U.S. forced removal of that term from the Treaty of Paris, was conscription of sailors, which is what started the War of 1812. Up until then, the United Kingdom could board any ship and take anybody they wanted and just Shanghai them, quite literally. And in some cases, they sent them to Shanghai to haul opium. But the laws, the Admiralty laws, generally are not enforced the way they were intended and have been practiced for 3,000 years, give or take. Finders keepers being the biggest one. So treasure nowadays is claimed by anybody who can, you know, submit the paperwork. That's usually governments, whether it's state governments, federal governments, or international governments. They'll say, oh no, that's ours. And Spain has exercised that quite heavily, with some of the wrecks from the, you know, conquistadors, sending gold back to the King of Spain. Well, you know, it wasn't their gold to begin with. It belonged to the Aztecs and Mayas, the Peruvian, Inca, half a dozen or a couple dozen different cultures. They just strong-armed them and stole their gold and anything else they wanted. But they destroyed books, incidentally, and that wasn't the government. That was the religious overseers of those conquistadors. They destroyed the Mayan books. They destroyed the Aztec books. They burned for 17 days in Mexico City. Think about how many books that is.
It's on the same level or worse than the Alexandria fire.
Well, there may have been a couple of different fires in Alexandria. Probably under Roman / Christian, and probably again under the Caliph, who also tore down all the ancient, not all, but a lot of the ancient monuments to build new mosques. The Christians did some of that too. The Spanish did a lot of it in South America. You can still find inscribed stones, inscribed in ancient languages and scripts, in the historic era churches and whatnot in South America and some in Central America. But the writing systems, there were at least two dozen different writing systems in the Americas when the Spanish got here. Some of them were legible to people from the old world, incidentally.
That's one of those things that, you know, everybody sort of overlooks. And they, you know, this past few weeks, people that celebrate the Columbus Day holiday and all that, they never seem to question when it's brought up. And it's brought up in, I guess we would call the legend of Columbus coming to the New World, that when he landed. And, you know, he never actually landed on the continental mass. But
not on North America. He did in Central America. He brushed it just a little.
But they didn't seem to have that much of a communication problem, did they? I mean, that's...
Right. That's where it gets really interesting. On his first voyage, he arrived in the New World, Santo Domingo, and immediately conscripted, meaning kidnapped, a native to force that native to tell him where to find gold. Well, how did he do that? And how did that native know that 210 miles south-southeast they would find gold in a creek if they weren't already very sophisticated and, spoke multiple languages? How did that happen? Nobody has ever addressed that, and yet he did it.
Yeah, I've always wondered, you know, who was the translator? Yeah, but then you look at the facts of what can happen. People get caught on rafts, small boats. They get caught in trade winds, and they could be brushed from the coast of Africa, or if they're coming out of Portugal or Spain, and they can quite easily, under the wrong circumstances, if you want to look at it, being misfortune, they can end up in Brazil. They can end up in one of the Caribbean islands.
Yep. The Bay of Rio, there was an incident a couple decades back where somebody found a bunch of Roman amphora, you know, pottery, vases, whatever, probably wine casks. And the Brazilian government almost immediately, went out and dumped several hundred tons of sand over the area so you couldn't even see them anymore. And they found somebody to say, oh, no, I planted them there. It's like, really? You planted 1,700-year-old amphora in the Bay of Rio? That's a little bizarre all by itself. But they probably, that particular one, they still had wine when they got there. Now, when you talk to Robert Ballard, who is, in my opinion, the undisputed champion of underwater archaeology and a lot of things having to do with underwater stuff, he says that the Mediterranean, you can follow the trade routes because it's littered with empty wine jugs. Just like today, you can follow fishermen and it'll be littered with empty beer cans. But it's the same effect. When they were done with them, over the board they went. But they still had at least 18 jugs of wine when they got to the Bay of Rio. Interesting. They were well supplied. They were well outfitted, and they traversed, I don't know, at least 1,100 miles from their origin, even if it was, you know, off the coast of Africa. So they were sophisticated, and they knew what they were doing. Now, the other option is, okay, it was Roman wine, but it wasn't a Roman ship. Well, okay, how did they get Roman wine to Rio if it, you know, either way, somebody was sailing the Atlantic with intent. That's where it gets really interesting. What was the intent? Well, in most cases, you would immediately go to trade or conquest. That's what the Spanish did. It's what the English did. What the French did. It's what the Russians did. It was trade and or conquest. Usually, one disguised as the other. The English did it everywhere that they could, and the sun never set on the British Empire. Well, okay, until the middle of the 20th century, and then it lost a lot of it. The very end of the 20th century, was Hong Kong. But now Hong Kong's trying to come back because they don't like the Chinese much. Anyway, the idea that sailed is the pertinent point there.
Yeah, they weren't sailing by accident in that case.
Correct.
You know, I just wonder, you know, how do you have that much sand just handily? Oh, well, yeah, this is just on a dredge barge or something. We'll just go dump it here.
Yeah. It's intent. But evidence, if you, and those bits of evidence, part of what we'll discuss at this conference is coming up next weekend. Do you want to launch into that? Do you need to take a break at any time?
Well, we're going to actually take a break in about 20 minutes, Rick. So if you want to give people the details on it, I'm pretty sure they're now exceptionally curious.
Okay. There's a conference coming up in Washington, Indiana, which is the southwest corner of Indiana. It is next Saturday and Sunday, the 1st and 2nd of November. A dozen or so speakers and probably about 14 different presentations, depending on how much question and answer period we end up doing. We have extra presentations at the ready. There will be artifacts and books and magazines and whatnot, artifacts to view and books and magazines and videos for sale. The speakers, wow, what a list of speakers. Start off with Wayne May, who's a publisher of Ancient American Magazine and a good friend of mine, and I've been writing for the magazine for well over a year now. Wow, I'm getting some feedback.
Yeah, we have a little bit of a echo there.
Okay, well, anyway, I'll just barge forward. About 21 years. And he has seen countless examples of out-of-place artifacts. And that's the core of what drives the diffusionist movement. That is, things that show up that shouldn't be here if the history were accurate. But they're here, so the history can't be completely accurate. Wayne, I'm not sure what Wayne's presentation will be. He has a couple dozen that he can run through, but he updates everything all the time. We also have Jim Shears, Dr. James Shears, who is professor emeritus in civil engineering at University of Wisconsin-Madison. His specialty is surveying ancient earthworks and mounds and whatnot. He's also the founder and chief scientist for the Ancient Earthworks Society. Jim has worked on several sites around here because I finally got him involved in some that I can't really resolve all by myself. I don't have the surveying skills, and I don't have the network that he has to get native information about what these things might be or how old they might be. So Jim will be talking a little bit about that. And we also have Dr. John White, who is an epigrapher. For folks who don't know what that is, they study ancient writing systems and scripts and languages and stone tablets that have those languages and scripts engraved on them. And John will be here doing a couple of presentations. One of them is about the Burroughs Cave map stones, and I'm not really sure what his other one is, but it will be good. I know that. I've known John for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years now, and he is an outstanding individual and outstanding in his field of study. Let's see. We have a guy by the name of Brian Motzinger, who is a history teacher in Illinois, and he has been tracking down a number of stone fortresses that were scattered across Illinois, and they're prehistoric in nature. They've been known and mapped in the past, but then some of them have been lost because the state didn't keep up with all of it, although a couple of amateurs back in the 30s and 40s did. One of them even established a tour of them. And Brian has studied all of his materials, and he's added a couple back onto the state list because he was able to follow those tourist materials. And he's on the trail of a couple more that we're pretty sure exist, but we haven't actually found yet. He hasn't actually found them yet. He gets all the credit for that one. We've got Fritz Zimmerman, who is the author of the Nephilim Chronicles, and that's a two-book set. One is a tour guide, if you will, of ancient mounds of Indiana, Ohio, a little bit West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Kentucky. But the other one talks about, the Nephilim Chronicles talks about who these people were, particularly in the Edina period. They were tall. They had round skulls. They used copper. They had very sophisticated archaeoastronomy, or just astronomy at their time. Skills as well as mathematics and surveying, and they were smart. And did I mention they were tall, like 7, 8, 9 feet tall? They were big folks. They were a whole lot like the Bell Beaker people of Western Europe, incidentally. We also have Kent Christen, who will be bringing a large, heavy artifact in tow. It is a carved stone head that's about life-size bust, not just a head. It's closer to a bust, long-haired, bearded individual. His beard's longer than mine, or there would be more resemblance. He does not have a halo on his head, but he looks a lot like the depictions of Jesus that we're all used to. Kent has a lot of other experiences that he can talk about. Also a very talented researcher. Frank Joseph. Frank is... wow. An author, but he is a very, very, very prolific author. I don't know how many books he's got to his credit now, something around 20. Many of them on the subject of Atlantis, many others on the lost technology, the lost civilizations of North America, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, if you want somebody with an encyclopedic knowledge of the lore of Atlantis, well, he wrote the Encyclopedia of Atlantis. So he's the guy. Who else have I got on that list? Let's see. Mike Dudney, which is not his real name, but he will be here discussing some of the ancient, what we call Birdman tablets. This is a character that, a recurring character across vast stretches of geography, usually associated with Mississippian culture, but this person, this entity, whether it was a perceived deity or whatever this person was or this entity was, he was known for tens of thousands of square miles. And he was depicted in these places, usually on sandstone tablets, but other articles as well. And Mike will be talking about that. Who else is on there? Oh, yeah, I'm on there. I'll be talking, I'll be talking about the fortresses of the Ohio Valley. As well as how they communicated with each other and what they traded, how they did it, how they talked to the source, to the customer over thousands of miles and got the messages right. And yes, they did. And I'll be comparing that to some of the practices of the old world, which used the same method, if not the exact same technology, which is kind of cool. So it starts, the presentation starts at noon next Saturday, the 1st, noon Eastern, in Washington, Indiana, at the Eastside Park in the RSVP Volunteer Center. We can only seat 288 people, and it's going to get tight, I believe. I believe that will be capped. We may end up turning a couple people away. Don't know for sure. But we're going to be pretty close to capacity. But there's right now, there's still a little room. It's $25 at the door. And for the next 5 days, you can also register, pre-register for $20 via PayPal at smnadman@gmail.com.
So and do you want to give that out again, Rick, or do you have a website that is set up specifically for the event?
We have a Facebook event set up. You can also find details at Graves of the Golden Bear on Facebook. That's my book fan page, I guess you call it, on Facebook, Graves of the Golden Bear. It has details. But as far as the pre-registration, it's extended to the 30th of October. Just send $20 via PayPal to SMN, that's Sam, Michael, Nancy, Adman, Adam, Delta, Michael, Adam, Nancy, @gmail.com, and give the names of the people who are registering and preferably your hometown. We're trying to get some data on who all's coming from where. That'll aid us if we do another one.
Yeah, and you have to blame people like Frank Joseph and Wayne May for doing such spectacular work, and causing the event hall to be full. So.
Pretty much, yes. It's not my name that's drawing people in. But actually, the whole topic is interesting to a wide range of people. Most people don't pursue it actively. They'll say, I read something in the paper the other day, or I saw this on the internet, or I watched America Unearthed. And by the way, about half the speakers have appeared in that program. But as far as actively pursuing it, they don't. Up until the last few years, there was not a widely popular following for this kind of stuff, or at least I didn't think so. Then I got to looking at the book sales on some of these more intricate or more individualized topics, and it's like, wow, this rivals UFO stuff.
A lot of people would look at it and say, well, pardon the pun, but it's a little bit more grounded.
It is a little more grounded.
And kudos to everybody with the production team. I know that Scott Walter has been on the same program multiple times, and my wife's usually too busy to be in the studio or listening, and so she decided last week to start off with the recorded episodes that are available for America Unearthed, and she instantly became hooked.
Well, I don't agree with all their conclusions, and Scott knows that. But Scott wrote the foreword for my book. I've stayed overnight at his house. And I've invited him here, but he hasn't come yet. Eventually he will, because some of the things around here are just too important to ignore. So the premise, the idea that it is becoming popular is very gratifying to me, not for my own book sales so much as, wow, maybe I wasn't quite as crazy as a lot of people thought in pursuing this stuff. Because I actually started pursuing it back in, the middle of the last century, when I was about 14 or 15 years old. And I'm 61 now. So it's been on my mind for a long time.
And there are other people listening. Rick, we're also broadcast on the English language channel for Chinese public broadcasting. there are some things that have been dug up in China that are of interest to, let's say, the authorities that, you know, the average person on the street might not be aware of that information, but it's not entirely out of the question that you may end up with some Chinese archaeologists that are looking for connections to things.
Or American archaeologists that are finding Chinese artifacts 3,000 years old in America. It has happened already. 2,150 years old. 1421, Kevin Minci's pursuit, is becoming more and more plausible even to the doctrinal archaeologists and historians because of, let's say, corroborating evidence found in China, as well as here, and not just artifacts, but also records. So those things are going to come to light at some point, despite a great deal of academic resistance to them. So be it, I guess. The truth has to come out sometime.
And I guess, you know, we have about 7 or 8 minutes or so, Rick, before the top of the hour we take our break. Folks, you've been listening to Rick Osmond on Voice of the People Radio this afternoon. In these last few minutes, maybe we could touch on the importance of preservation and what somebody should do if they discover something, because they could be digging along a creek bed, they could be putting up a fence in their backyard.
Or they could be using a metal detector. And that's a big one. I'll give you an example. This happened to me just over a year ago. I was on a little lecture tour with Wayne out west in Utah. And a part of my book touches on the occurrence of Roman coins along the rivers and coastlines of the eastern United States. Everything east of the Rockies, in fact, just about every state east of the Rockies has had ancient Roman coins turn up. But there had never been any west of the Rockies. Guy came up to me and he said, "Hold out your hand." And he dumped 24 Roman coins into my hand. He found them while he was metal detecting. He said, "In all, there are 386 of them." Well, that just about doubles the known Roman coins in North America. That is, not in collections. And I said, "Did you leave any?" He said, "Well, I don't think so." And I said, "Well, I appreciate you showing them to me, but if they're not in situ, they are not useful as evidence."
Mm-hmm.
So anybody who is a metal detectorist, if you find a Roman coin and you have hits around it, leave the rest of them for later, please, under supervised excavation techniques. Because if they're not in situ, they're not useful as evidence. And the same goes for a lot of things, not just metal stuff. If you find, you know, an amphora, well, if you find the rim and the handle of an amphora, you're pretty sure the rest of it's there someplace. Just leave it for now and let somebody dig it up under supervised and very well provenienced conditions. Because if you don't have good records, it never happened. You made it. It's a fake. You're a hoaxer. You're out for profit. It's like, really? Because I thought I was going to help science. No, science doesn't want your help. They want to dig it up for themselves. And if they don't dig it up for themselves, it's a hoax or a misinterpretation or something. It's not real. It can't be real. So that's my my plea to people who find stuff. Leave it, or at least leave part of it. There was another example in Michigan. A father and son on a farm kept digging up these little stone discs. Most of them were disc-shaped, and they had engravings on them. And the archaeologist, "You're faking this. You're doing this yourself." They finally got one archaeologist to say, "We have never dug over there, but it's in the line of where we have dug, and I'll bet you can find some." And he did, in situ. So now it's an accepted phenomenon. It's an accepted group of artifacts, and they're on display in a museum. And this guy got a good paper out of it. That's the archaeologist's reward. He gets to publish something that nobody ever dreamed existed. And he did it under good, provenienced, supervised excavation techniques. And that's what it takes.
There are places, too, that you're not allowed to take a metal detector, and I find that sort of interesting.
That is true in almost all state parks and federal lands, incidentally.
And it's, you know, I don't think that what they're trying to keep you from doing is finding out if somebody was out, you know, hunting or whatnot, and they didn't collect their brass.
Yeah. That's my main reason that I want a metal detector is I've got a lot of loose brass out behind the house. But, and it deteriorates too quickly to be even sold to scrap, usually. But my grandfather, before this place was surface mined, he found a flintlock pistol out in the pasture. All broken down, all rusty, not useful, but interesting. Where did that come from? Well, I think it was probably his great-great-grandfather's, you know, the same guy that was the witness in the trial. Because this was his escape route from the unnamed big Indian.
Yeah, and hopefully if unnamed big Indian has some descendants, you know, they will also find it interesting. There's a lot of people across America who have been displaced over the course of hundreds of years, and many of these things are attributed to their culture. But they don't have any, you know, they don't have any direct knowledge of some of these artifacts, and some of the things may end up, in fact, being sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it is so important that if you find something, if you can, you know, leave it alone. And it doesn't matter if your first contact is a junior history professor at the local community college; they will know somebody to get in touch with.
Right. And in a lot of cases, if it is suspected to be an out-of-place artifact at any level, they'll just ignore you. But don't give up. Find somebody with the skills, abilities, and connections to make it happen.
Yeah, and sort of end up being a little bit on guard as mm-hmm. well, because you might end up with the wrong set of ears hearing some information
right.
and have somebody on your property in the middle of the night.
There are countless tales, accounts, of the Smithsonian saying, boy, we sure like that. We'd love for you to give it to us. And that's what happens. And it's never heard from or seen again. We don't know what you're talking about. We don't have such a thing, and we don't have any record of it.
And that's sort of something I guess we can lead the audience into a little bit, because as much as they wouldn't want to believe that there's any level of corruption with something like the Smithsonian Institution, you might beg to differ, but we'll have to wait until the second half of the show. Rick, if you're going to stick around with me, folks, you are listening to Voice of the People Radio on United Public Radio Network at 107.7 FM New Orleans, 107.9 and 105.3 FM in beautiful Pass Christian, Mississippi. This is Voice of the People Radio. My guest is Rick Osmond. I'm your host, Greg Miller. We'll be right back after these words from UPRN.
A night out at the Village is great, and I love the fountain.
Well, saw the thing.
Ghosts.
Spirits.
Demons.
Reincarnation.
Past lives.
The afterlife.
Divination.
Exorcisms.
Witchcraft.
The unseen.
He's psychic medium Chris George.
And he's Victor the Voice Fireman.
We are Second Sight Radio. Join us live
every Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time
on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
If you are listening to the show and wish to join us in the chat room, visit paltalk.com. Go to the social issues, select other, and enter the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in to the Mind Cemetery with your hosts Chip and Nicole every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepy topics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway, mindcemetery.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we host News on the Flip Side. Come join us every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Central for our three-hour program. We have opinions on everything, and we're not afraid to share them. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can find it here with News on the Flip Side. Remember, don't be politically correct. Just be correct. Join us.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
FM and Past Christianity 0.97 FM in beautiful downtown New Orleans. I'd like to thank the production staff for keeping up their excellent end of things. Today we have with us Rick Osmond, who is author of Graves of the Golden Bear. You can check out Rick's fan page and all for the book itself on Facebook, and also catch some more information about an upcoming conference which is being held in his neck of the woods. And it's almost sold out, folks, but I'm pretty sure that if you go to Facebook, you look up Rick Osmond, it's spelled O-S-M-O-N, and Graves of the Golden Bear, you'll be able to find the Facebook page for the book and some more information on the upcoming conference and how to register and all of those details. And it's really interesting every time Rick comes on the show to share with us some stuff. And when we say stuff, what we mean is things that aren't exactly what they appear to be, and they're a little bit out of place when it comes to what we've been taught. Whether you have a middle school or grade school education or high school education, you're given certain bits of information about how things are supposed to have gone in the last 1,000 or so years. And sometimes people find things that just don't fit, and what we call those things are out-of-place artifacts. And Rick happens to live this lifestyle, which has led him to research and know probably more about it than even Rick might say he should.
Well, yeah, more than I'm supposed to. If my education had been effective, I often quote Mark Twain, who said, "I am proud to say I got an education in spite of going to school."
Yeah, and when it comes to something that's supposed to preserve what we learn or what we're educatable upon, The Smithsonian Institute was originally founded for the preservation of knowledge and fact.
And, well, yeah, and it has an interesting story of its origin all by itself. A guy by the name of Smithson, who was a chemical engineer, mining engineer, and probably one of the richest people as a result of his activities in the United Kingdom, left his entire fortune to...
I couldn't wait to see her again,
the United
but
States
I didn't want her to see my psoriasis.
What became known as the Smithsonian Institution. But because of the intricacies of law within the United States, the money could not go directly to that. It had to go through the general fund of the United States and had to be voted on by Congress. Well, that was the first mistake, in my opinion, because it gave Congress control of how things should be done. And it just got worse from there. From 1840 up until 1880, they did that. They went out and they studied and they collected pretty much everything that they thought was pertinent to the pre-Columbian history of the United States and North America in general. But in 1881, a guy, and they worked in concert with the United States Geological Survey.
What'd you get to drink?
And they studied samples, and they gathered samples, and they gathered information on what were the natural resources of the United States and how best to exploit them. And because they were out in the field gathering all this information, they were also gathering all of these artifacts and out-of-place artifacts, things that just didn't seem to fit quite right. And there was a guy by the name of Major John Wesley Powell who had lost his arm in the Civil War at Shiloh under Grant. He had been later on sponsored to go down the Colorado River with one arm, by the way, first guy to ever traverse the Colorado River against, you know, all odds because, well, he only had one arm to steer with. And he was successful. And he became what I call a cookie-cutter hero. It was the last thing to conquer in the United States because we didn't have Alaska yet. Anyway, he conquered it. And somebody, one of his sponsors, a guy by the name of Senator Semple, S-E-M-P-L-E, said, you didn't have a photographer. We need pictures for this. So he did it again with a photographer and became world famous and, you know, became an Indian agent. He was appointed as an Indian agent. I had zero experience for that. But he was also very adept at writing things. Again, this is stuff that's in the literature, therefore it must be true, right? Well, he wrote on topics for which he had zero experience. He wrote on topics for which he had zero authority or training. He never got a college education. He never completed college. He went to college, went to two different colleges. He never got a degree until one was sent to him from a foreign college. And yet he became the second director of the USGS and established and chaired the department or the Bureau of Ethnicity at the Smithsonian Institution. In other words, he got himself into a position with a lot of help from people who were very powerful to dictate what the policies would be, not only on things like where railroads would go, but what materials they would use in the construction of those railroads and what it meant if you actually found one of these rocks with writing on it. Well, it meant nothing because it's just chicken scratches. It's just doodles by Indians. Didn't mean anything. Had no connection whatsoever to Old World. Well, from 1881 up until his death in 1902, he dictated a lot of things. And his word became doctrine for two different governmental organizations. And yes, the Smithsonian Institution is a governmental organization because that's where they get all their money. Okay, they didn't get all the money that Smithson sent them even. Congress kept that and they doled it out accordingly, according to their whims. And still do, incidentally. But the even more interesting, bringing it into current day, the National Science Foundation shares a lot of its board members. The individuals are also members of the Rockefeller Foundation. And they decide what gets studied and what the results will say. Sorry, that's just the way it is.
And it's very interesting to note that the thing that these people all have had in common over the last couple hundred years since all this started was allocation of resources or the ways to acquire and hold on to said resources.
Yeah. Well, it also goes back to who was here before us, even in historical times. The French aided the very young United States, even before it was the United States, in its independence as well as in its negotiations for borders and conditions of a truce, or in that case, an actual treaty. The Treaty of Paris drew a line across the Great Lakes, right? And it just kind of bisected each of the Great Lakes, except for Lake Superior, where they drew a big loop out around Isle Royale. Well, it wasn't for another 70 years that people started mining pure copper off of Isle Royale. That is, in modern times. In very vastly far ancient times, people were already mining copper off of it. The French knew this, or they would not have convinced Ben Franklin to put that in the map while he was negotiating the Treaty of Paris. So the French knew it. Probably the English government knew it as well, but they were overwhelmed. Then in 1803, when Napoleon Bonaparte was kind of backed up into a corner in his fight with, well, England, he said, okay, United States, I'll not only sell you rights to New Orleans, because that's all he really went after, was the rights to pass through New Orleans on the Mississippi River. And they ended up with not only the city of New Orleans, but the entire Louisiana Territory. As a trade zone, they had the exclusive right to trade with whoever lived in that territory. The Louisiana Purchase was not a purchase of the land itself. Both the French and Thomas Jefferson understood that the Indians owned that land. What we were getting from the French was exclusive right to trade with those Indians. And that all goes back to that whole papal bull and Columbus discovery, which is a legal term of art, not an actual historical event. So the French helped us along with all that. That means they already knew a lot of this stuff. And in 1716, there was a guy by the name of Delisle. He was a geographer. He was, in fact, the royal court geographer for France, the King of France, he was the heir apparent. He wasn't king yet. So part of Delisle's job was to educate him on the state of the state of France. You know, this is what we own. This is what we control. This is what's there. This is who we're up against to retain that control, etc. And he drew a map of the Louisiana Territory. And there are some apparent errors in that map. Errors that a highly educated geographer of his stature would not make unless it was intentional.
And that goes back to something like a map in the hands of your enemy. Literally, it is a map to the resource that you want to keep hidden, that you want to have as a state secret.
Or the information that you don't want out because, well, you don't really have the legal right to sell it because you don't really own it. That's that goes back to the courthouse fires. Something was burned on purpose because it showed something that somebody didn't want known. And that's what this map said. I got to educate the king or the heir apparent, and yet I don't want this information getting out to any of our enemies. So almost certainly there was a narrative, a handwritten probably narrative, probably in three or more copies, to go with that map. See over there in this legend that's on paper means this, and oh, by the way, this is in code too in this narrative. And that code, which had been around by then for nearly 100 years in France, is called the Grand Cipher. And it remained unbroken until the 1890s. So it was in effect for, 289 years, unbroken. And it was used by everybody in one form or another. It was the French military and the French diplomacy in the French government that had to use ciphers for anything. One of those people, incidentally, was Marquis de Lafayette, who sided with, you know, Jefferson, Washington, et cetera, to fight the British, and was very effective at it. Probably provided that cipher, or that system of cipher, because that's what it really is, of the Revolution. Thomas Jefferson mastered it. You know, he was a genius anyway, but he mastered it, and he had, by my studies, it indicates that he had a separate cipher key for each of his correspondents, and he could do it all in his head. He was an amazing intellect that way. So in 1803, when he...
Do you think that, you sort of touched on it there, do you think that the information was then coming from multiple sources, or do you think that there was something going on within the expedition itself to have, you know, one set of cipher go back with some of the information about some of these mines and other things, and then another set of information in case it was intercepted?
Yes. And that was a fairly common practice as well. When Washington was camped outside of Yorktown, multiple spies chasing the same information and reporting on a daily basis.
John Wesley Powell, Rick, doesn't it? It seems sort of odd that they would give claim to all of these expeditions and things to a guy with one arm to navigate the Colorado River. It seems to me that there might have been a follow-up, you know, or a go-behind expedition, and it's been kept secret.
Yeah, there is that possibility. I haven't found any distinct evidence of it, but the excuse that you didn't have a photographer seems a little bit of a stretch. The information was no less accurate with or without a photographer. So my conjecture is that there was something there, and the follow-up was to either move it, destroy it, hide it, or study it. And of course, in 1917, you had the Kincaid expedition that reported an Egyptian cave, if you will, or burial chamber, or some kind of a huge undertaking, within the walls of the Grand Canyon. Of course, and that was all supposedly associated with the Smiths, who disclaims any knowledge of it. So I don't know.
That's
maybe.
I guess that's one of the things with the stuff the Smithsonian has covered up over the years. I can't name the sources, but I know people who have given personal anecdotes to being in some underground storage facilities in the United States, somewhat akin to the Raiders of the Lost Ark, where at the very end of everything you see the Ark being deposited underground or in something that's just completely almost unbelievable. And I say almost because we are discovering of late that our government indeed can be up to no good.
Well,
it sounds like we might be having a little bit of...
That's where you get into the whole shadow government thing. Is it our government, or is it somebody within our government, or is it a completely different entity that uses our government? All those things are possible in my view. But I don't have anything to say. Yes, that's the case.
This whole disclosure thing with the Vatican putting written documents out for public consumption, it sort of reminds me of that magician's trick where you watch one hand and you don't know what the other one is doing. It leads me to be somewhat suspicious of who in the Vatican may be involved in stuff that goes on that gets hidden by people like the Smithsonian Institution. And they have their reasons.
Well, yeah, the whole Freedom of Information, the whole Freedom of Information Act is, let's see, yeah, it's a hat trick. Because if you get the right person in any particular organization, they'll say, do you have a document number for that? And if you don't have a document number, then I can't help you. Well, how are you supposed to know a document number for something that is secret? So the whole Freedom of Information Act is a canard. There is information that will never, ever be released. There is also information that cannot be released for, say, 75 years after an event, Kennedy assassination being one of those. Why? Wait, isn't that national history? It's world history, in fact. And yet you can't talk about it for 75 years? I'm sorry, but this does not add up. And there are other cases like that. But the whole thing about the cipher with Meriwether Lewis... was years after the incident. And disinterment has been denied by National Park Service because, oh, wait, there are other people there. And we don't know exactly who's buried where. We have some very, very sophisticated ground-penetrating radar that would be able to tell where the bodies are buried, quite literally. But they won't allow it. James Starr, who is probably the world's best forensic pathologist, advocated worked for, coerced, cajoled to get that body disinterred so that do an examination on whatever was left. And it would be easy to tell if it was Lewis because the accounts say that part of his skull was shot off. It wouldn't be hard to tell him from his neighbor, even while it was still buried, probably. So there's no real excuse for that, and yet they deny it. The family has advocated and begged National Park Service for that privilege of digging up their ancestor. Well, not direct ancestor, great uncle type, because he didn't have any kids of his own. He was never married. But he was almost certainly murdered rather than self-inflicted gunshot wounds from a muzzleloader. Players asked and killed 940, I think it was, troops, okay, militia, in one day, in one single battle, and they lost like 16 of theirs. So Wayne was chartered by George Washington to build an army for the United States. They called it a Legion of the United States. Wilkinson always thought that he should have been the one chosen. Of course, by 1895, when that battle occurred, he had already been an employee of the Spanish government for 18 years. He was a double, possibly triple agent throughout his life. And he died in Mexico City. In it. The governor of the territory and president for 41 days until he died in pneumonia. Mad Anthony Wayne died of when he was on his way to bring
sounds a little bit
all the intrigue. Fled the country,
you know,
rather than be hanged without a trial. Go ahead. You
of about 10,000 people working on extracting copper for 1,000 years.
1,000 people for 10,000. Yeah, some of those mines 1,000 years old. We now have core data from Greenland saying that people were smelting copper 7,000 BC.
Qualcuno parla italiano?
Italiano? In fact, by a couple thousand years.
That we everything that we learn in our history course, whether it be grade school, high school, college, and kind of throws it out the window.
Well, it gives us a starting point.
Come on, let me hear something. Parla italiano, per favore.
I guess threw up my train of thought there, Rick. we end up with a lot of different starting points in various places around the world, and this whole thing goes back to trying to understand a little bit better how the people that were here when Columbus arrived got here, why they were here, what they were doing, and
who they were. There were multiple cultures within the American continents. There were multiple ethnicities, some very slight variation, some greater distinction of lineage. You've got a little bit of everything from what they call the haplo X mitochondrial DNA, which is most prevalent in the east coast of Canada, and even with a little bit of R1B, which is very purely European origin, and yet you've got almost nothing from Siberia, even though, as far as the X, you've got a lot of Siberian mitochondrial DNA, but not in the east coast of Canada. When you go to the Maritimes of Canada, you have clothing and musical instruments and hunting techniques and songs and languages that are not identical, but so similar to the counterparts of the northern Nordic, specifically the Sami peoples, that you can't imagine that they're not closely related, and yet they're not closely related genealogically. And yet their cultures are so similar as to be almost indistinguishable. They build their altars the same way. They dye and make their clothes the same way. Their fabrics are woven the same way. Their tools are made out of the same stuff with the same appearances, used the same way. Their musical instruments are used the same way, made the same way. Their boats are made very, very, very similar. You have snowshoes showing up on both sides in ancient times, but not in modern times. Snowshoes didn't exist in modern Scandinavia until after the historical period in America. What's wrong with this picture? There used to be a lot of interpersonal relationships, so to speak, as well as long-distance trade. I mentioned earlier that I've been writing for Ancient American Magazine, and this upcoming issue, which will be out sometime early December, my article talks about a trade arrangement that existed between Cahokia, Illinois, and all of its satellites, that is, all of the Mississippian cultures, and South America. There was a commodity that was traded from South America into North America on a regular and extensive basis, but it was consumable. It all disappeared. It just left traces in pottery, and that has been proven in pottery studies just this calendar year, incidentally. It's an exciting thing for diffusionists. 2,800 miles of trade route. I don't think they did it all on foot, though.
Well, that brings up that interesting question that comes to mind. You see things, documentaries about archaeology, and they will say, well, these people traveled by boat, but these people over here didn't have the wheel. How is that possible?
And yet they had stone roads with ruts, but they didn't have a wheel. The Spanish documented stone-paved roads, particularly in Inca Peru, and that they had ruts from iron-bound wheels in those roads, and yet you can't find any trace of those today. They also documented Roman-style arches, but that's not in the historical literature of today. It's in personal accounts. They had writing that we know, not in Peru so much, but certainly in Mexico and Bolivia and Guatemala. The Mayas were prolific bookkeepers, both for accounting purposes as well as historical and other accounts. So were the Aztecs. Apparently, so were some of the North American tribes. They kept records, perhaps in a different way, but they kept records. We can't read them directly. The Peruvians didn't use paper or parchment or anything like that. Their writing system involved thread and knots, and there are some very dedicated people who are learning to read the Quipi, or Quipi, depending on how you choose to pronounce it, which is a bunch of strings with knots and colors, and they tell stories. They don't just count llamas. They tell stories. Apparently.
It's interesting because, you know, with the story that is bound up in the knots and the rope, you also have evidence of, in some cases, trade with different areas, because they would also, as you said, color these things.
Yeah.
And you'll find that in Mayan culture and others that they used certain types of dyes which were made from minerals which were not available where they lived.
Right. And that's another, well, the initial episode of America on Earth talked about that. They found a blue colored mineral in Georgia. It also occurred other places, but its highest concentration is northwest Georgia. And it is Maya blue. And people have wondered for, you know, as long as they've been studying Mayan culture, where they got this, because they couldn't find any source for it in the Yucatan. Well, there isn't a source for it in the Yucatan. The source is in Georgia. So they were obviously trading that far. And that's not the only, and that's one of the things that went back to Maya country. What came to Georgia in exchange was consumable, and it disappeared from the record because, well, they consumed it. What did they use for money? Well, Montezuma used cocoa or cacao as money, and he used a lot of it. He and his lords consumed a lot of it when they had a feast. Well, on a daily basis, they consumed a lot of it. But it was their currency, their de facto currency. They didn't use gold or turquoise or whatever, but they traded it for gold and turquoise and whatever, and apparently also for a blue mineral from Georgia.
And that makes the cultural diffusion all that more interesting, because if you find an area where there's really nobody living, but you figure out that you can cultivate something and you're using what you're cultivating as your form of currency, controlling and using that area for agriculture for that particular resource becomes all that more valuable for you as a cultural whole.
It becomes essential as a governmental entity. You are controlling the currency. You're controlling the money of an entire country, an entire culture, not just national boundaries. And the U.S. dollar is an example of that. It's used pretty much all over the world, not so much now as it was even 10 years ago, but it's still useful all over the world. You want a cab ride, you hold out dollars, you'll get your cab ride, even in Singapore.
Yeah, it's something else. And that's, you know, I guess that would be a touchstone for something else entirely that we probably don't have time to get into. But it's funny because we have that cultural expression, money doesn't grow on trees.
But in Maya country, it did. It was tradable goods, tradable for almost anything because, well, it's semi-addictive. It has compounds within it, including caffeine. We got into that earlier a little bit about the coffee, but before the show. The caffeine is not truly physiologically addictive, although it has some traits that seem to be, you know, you quit drinking coffee all of a sudden. If you're a heavy coffee drinker, and you quit drinking coffee, you'll have persistent headaches for weeks, and they're annoying. But that probably wasn't the only commodity that was traded from the Yucatan, but it certainly drew a lot of resources into the Yucatan. And then in about 800 AD, our calendar, the Yucatan, the high culture of the Yucatan, moved away. And apparently moved to, well, Cahokia. And their platform pyramid was made out of dirt instead of stone. If they'd had another 500 years, it probably would have been stone encased. In fact, part of it was, and then they built over that too.
And we talk about the trade between the regions in North and Central and South America, Rick. But what sort of evidence do we have, because we know that these people aren't going to have a closed system for commodities being exchanged with the old world?
Well, the first hurdle to that, of course, is an ocean. But we also know that when Columbus arrived in the Carib Indians came out to meet him in a canoe with sails and 100 sailors. And it was longer than the Santa Maria. It was a seagoing canoe. It was a trade ship. It was a trade vessel with a large crew, capable of traversing, well, at least the Gulf of Mexico, because, well, that's what they were doing. So they had the resources and the skills and the abilities. And they were excellent at navigating by the stars. Oh, wait, so was Columbus.
It makes you wonder, you know, just how familiar those sailors were that were on that boat with places like what is now the port of New Orleans and the mouth of the Mississippi River.
Right. Well, you go upriver today about 75 miles and you get to a place called Poverty Point. And Poverty Point has so far yielded something on the order of 4 million artifacts that are clay balls. And they're fired. Most of them are fired, or they would have just been reabsorbed into the soil. And they are effigies, most of them, of people. Nobody knows why they made so many of them. The speculation conjecture is that they were used as cooking stones and thrown out with the garbage, because they're kind of semicircular around the center of the complex. But the center of the complex has seven separate rings. The outer five have been cut by the Mississippi River. So if the city was a full circle at one time, then the river has eaten more than a third of it. But the culture that was there also worked copper, bringing this full circle. And they had not just copper workshops, they also had evidence of very hot fires and other materials that would be consistent with copper smelting, as well as iron smelting. There is an archaeologist actually working that angle right now, and he has published in Ancient American on that. So one of the materials that would be essential to such smelting operations, particularly if you're going to make alloys, which we know that the Inca and Maya had alloys, and the Toltec and the Olmec, would be something that you could use as a flux. There are certain fluxes for certain purposes. If your ore has certain contaminants, you use one flux. If it's other contaminants, you use a different flux. A limestone is one of the first ones to get most of the just plain dirt out of it. But if you have, say, arsenic, then you use a different flux to get the arsenic out. There wasn't a lot of arsenic in the Michigan copper, but there's just traces, and it wasn't enough to hurt most people, unless they were just breathing the fumes all the time. But in Europe, getting arsenic out of the copper was essential because, well, it was thick. And the flux that is needed for that is a lot less available in the old world than it is in the new world, specifically at a place called Cave in Rock Quadrangle in southern Illinois, northwestern Kentucky. Cave in Rock is a unique place in a lot of ways, but the fluorspar, which is the flux, the mineral that's used as a flux, that was one of the best deposits and highest concentrations, certainly in the New World, and one of the best in the world. Now we're getting it all from India and China and I think some in Indonesia and Guyana and a few other places in Africa. But it is not as good as a fluorspar that was mined from Illinois for more than a century.
You know, that means that you have this potentially huge source of better copper located in the New World, and a great bulk of it had to be consumed. And this is long before the established copper age, but what we do know, or you know, what we're told is, you know, almost immutable fact. Who were the major copper consumers, you know, on the other side of everything in Europe, in the Near East, in Africa?
The Egyptians certainly used a lot, because if they used copper saws, and there's fair evidence they did, to saw up all that stone that was used in, 13.5 acres of just base acres of the Great Pyramid, then they probably consumed something on the order of 5 million pounds of copper just for that purpose, just that. And they didn't mine that much copper, not in Africa, not in the Mideast, because, well, it's not that good. And it would leave slag piles as big as the pyramid itself, and they don't exist.
It's a lot of the people look at the, when we talk about this in a historical context, they're more concerned with where something is, you know, on the map, and who knew where what was on the map. But we sort of overlook knowing what is there. You know, what is useful. I guess for the most part, we've talked a lot about what the natural resources are that have been available in these different places around the world. And that is, you know, the cardinal thing. It really doesn't do you very much good to know that a place is there if you don't know what you're going to be able to exploit once you get there and back.
Right. Or how long it's going to take, or how much work it will take to extract that resource, or what it takes to refine it. And those are all clues that we can actually chase within the pre-Columbian North American prehistory thing. And that's kind of the purpose of this conference coming up next weekend, and kind of specific to the greater Ohio Valley, which drains 14 states, incidentally. So it's a good chunk of what is now the United States. We've got people coming to this conference as attendees from New York, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, Illinois, and Louisiana. So people are interested, and they're interested from a long distance away.
And Rick, we want to give this out to folks in the audience that might be wondering if they didn't catch us in the first hour or they've listened all the way through the podcast. The Ancient Ohio Valley Copper Conference, as Rick just said, has pre-registered folks from 9 states. So there is still time, folks, and do your online pre-registration. It has been extended to October 30th, and you can register by sending $20 via PayPal to smnadman@gmail.com and state the name of the attendees and the hometown, please. And if you're confused about all that, you can also go to facebook.com/ type in Graves of the Golden Bear, and you'll find that information and more there from Rick Osmond. Rick, it's always fun. Would you also like to tell the audience about Graves of the Golden Bear?
Okay, very briefly, it is a compendium of not alternative history, but an alternative interpretation of history, starting with the legend of Prince Matic. That's where I started, And that's what the book is about. It's kind of my experiences in my research of 40 years from where I started to where I was in 2011 when the book was published. I've got more now, and I'm working on another book, but it talks about everybody from Prince Madoc to King Arthur to St. Brendan the Navigator to Meriwether Lewis and Thomas Jefferson, and of course John Wesley Powell. All those people are part of this entire story, and that's what I was trying to decipher in whatever it turned out to be 285 pages, I think, with a lot of maps and images that kind of illustrate what I'm after. Oh, did I mention the Roman Ninth Legion? Because they're part of that picture, too. The signet ring worn by officers of the Roman Ninth Legion had a bald eagle on it. What? What? How did they have a bald eagle?
It's one of those things. It's sort of like discovering reliefs in some of the Viking artwork or Norse artwork that has depictions of maize or corn.
Well, in India and Egypt, ancient Egypt, Gunnar Thompson,
I'm in the now,
has found 400 and I don't know about 420 different images in ancient Egyptian art that certainly seems to depict maize. Well, if they had never seen it, never been here, how did they know about it? How did they draw accurate pictures of it?
Yeah, and the maze itself is, you know, one of those things that people sometimes don't understand exactly how far back that goes and what it took for the Native Americans to cultivate it over multiple generations.
Yeah, they domesticated a wild plant. And if you believe the conventional interpretation, they did that in a period of 300 years. I'm sorry, it doesn't work like that. You know, soybeans have been around as a crop for 5,000 years, and they're still developing it.
If it were that possible, you know, that would shorten up some timetables for some people at places like Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and a few others. Yeah,
we're just not going to touch them with a 10,000-foot pole at this point. But it's been fun having you here with me this afternoon, folks. You've been listening to a caffeine-fueled episode of Voice of the People Radio on another Saturday afternoon. Rick Osman has been my guest. Rick Osman is the author of Graves of the Golden Bear. He's been talking with us about out-of-place artifacts and also the upcoming Ancient Ohio Valley Copper Conference. I'll get all that out. So if you want to see Frank Joseph and Wayne May and some other really cool people and get to meet them, shake their hands, maybe buy a copy of somebody's book if they're carrying it with them, that's going to be the place for you to go. And you can also check out Rick's page for Graves of the Golden Bear on Facebook.com. You just type that all in one word. And make sure to tell Rick that you heard him on Voice of the People Radio this afternoon. Folks, take down the call-in number. You can call in live during the show. Rick, we didn't really have anybody burning the phone lines up, but you can call into the studio at 504-273-7379 and write that down, folks, because you might want to call in during News on the Flip Side, which comes up next here on United Public Radio Network. Rick Osman, thanks for being our guest this afternoon.
Thank you, Greg.
And folks, you want to stay tuned and listen to Stephanie Benetti and Joe Montaldo co-hosting News on the Flip Side on 105.3 FM in Past Christian, Mississippi, 107.7 FM in beautiful downtown New Orleans. Without you, the listeners, there is no Voice of the People Radio. Thanks, Joe, and everybody back at the studio with United Public Radio Network for having us here to entertain you, and thanks again, Rick, for bringing some more of this to light, and I hope that you all have a very full center there with the Ancient Ohio Valley Copper Conference. It sounds like people kind of need to get on the stick. And
well, if they want to attend, they might need to get busy, yes. And thank you for having me, and hopefully we can do this again with or without a conference.
Of course. It's always, always fun. And folks, stay tuned for News on the Flip Side coming up next. I'm your host, Greg Miller. This has been another episode of Voice of the People Radio. And have a great afternoon, everybody.